12-13-24-52-CV, Ernest Health, Inc., DBA South Texas Rehabilitation Hospital versus Martin Castro.
May it please the court, and good morning.
Good morning.
Thank you. I've got 15 minutes on my clock. My name is Scott Novak. I am appellant counsel for Ernest Health, DBA South Texas Rehabilitation Hospital. I'll refer to them throughout the proceedings as STRH, just for the sake of brevity. This court asks a question about whether or not a plaintiff in a personal injury case can plead around Chapter 74 by amending its petition to remove facts and allegations supporting a health care liability claim, or is such a practice disallowed under settled Texas law? I would submit that the briefing that I have presented to this court, particularly with focuses on cases such as the Faber matter, which is a matter that I happen to be involved in previously, as well as Ross, the Lois Siga case, and other matters cited within my briefing, suggest that it's fairly well settled that a case may not be recast, transmuted, or changed from a Chapter 74 healthcare liability claim into a non-healthcare liability claim simply by amending pleadings and removing facts. And the way that the Supreme Court has approached this at the very top level is for a reviewing court such as yourself to look at the entire record holistically, to examine what they sometimes refer to as the universe of the record, to determine whether or not the claim could have been brought as a healthcare liability claim before making a determination of whether or not the case in fact falls inside or outside Chapter 74. In fact, I will refer again to the Faber matter. I sometimes refer to it as Smith versus Dayspring, but it is the Faber versus Collin Creek matter from last year, a Supreme Court matter, where they actually speak very specifically about the instructions to reviewing courts to look at the record holistically, and that the failure to do so can actually lead to an incorrect result. So, for example, only looking at a live pleading versus looking at the whole record, the previous pleadings, could lead to a incorrect result. And they were, of course, citing to the difference between the en banc panel at the Dallas Court of Appeals in that matter and the majority panel, which was authored, I believe that opinion was authored by Justice Rychek, where she examined with her colleagues the entire record to make a determination that that case was a healthcare liability claim. And just so that we can kind of talk about that case in, you know, parallel with the one we're dealing with today, the one we're dealing with today was originally pled by Mr. Castro, who is a stroke patient, having come to South Texas Rehabilitation Hospital for physical therapy. If you look at his first, his original and first amended petitions, he is very clear that what he is arguing is that he had a fall in a lobby, and the reason for the fall was the failure of the hospital and its staff to ensure his safety, to provide him supervision, to provide him assistance. In other words, the standard of care that would be viewed by a jury or trier of fact in a case such as this would be focused on what a healthcare provider would do with a patient such as this. After we challenged the case under Chapter 74 due to the failure to submit an expert report under that statutory scheme, the plaintiff amended his petition eventually to get to the second amended petition where everything had been excised. Smith versus Dayspring started that way. Obviously, that became Faber versus Collin Creek, same case. They did the same thing. They initially asserted a whole bunch of claims about the staff, about the, in that case, it was a patient care assistant who was pushing a woman who was a resident at an assisted care facility. They were pushing her on a wheeled walker, and the wheeled walker became entangled in a crack on the sidewalk outside of the facility, which was an issue in that case because it was alleged that this was not in a place where healthcare was provided. The Supreme Court disagreed.
So I can get to my question, sir.
Yes, Justice.
So if we are to look at the universe, as you called it, which I thought was a good way of this case.
I stole it from the Supreme Court.
The universe of this case. And stay away from the pleading, since we can't either plead ourselves out or in out of this medical malpractice. And looking at the Ross factors, and that's what I was trying to ascertain, how does Mr. Castro fit under the Ross?
Sure.
Besides that, because as you're looking at it, the Ross factors is really looking at patient, which is what Chapter 74 is supposed to be looking at, right? Mm-hmm. Healthcare and the patient care and what is being provided to the plaintiff in this circumstance. So as you look at Ross, it seems like there's a lot of this that don't fall to Mr. Castro.
Let me see if I can kind of direct that question, because I think it's a valid one. And this is a subtlety or a nuance that has to be sort of understood. The healthcare liability statute is broad, and it really allows three different healthcare liability claims. A healthcare claim, you violated the standard of care when you performed surgery, when you failed to intubate correctly, when you did a stitch the incorrect way, maybe you didn't provide proper supervision, maybe you didn't provide proper assistance in a rehabilitation hospital. That is a healthcare claim. It's a fairly straightforward analysis, usually a little bit more obvious. And I would submit that the Castro claim in the original petition, in the First Amendment petition, clearly asserts that kind of claim. He is alleging the hospital breached a standard of care. When we look at the universe, it is the whole record, including the pleadings. In fact, the Supreme Court has been very clear. We don't ignore the prior pleadings.
Right.
We pierce everything. Now, your question is more specific. It is Ross. Ross is very clear because it is a safety
claim. Right.
Mm-hmm. Now, safety does not have to directly relate to healthcare, hence the seven factors that we talk about in the Ross case. And I've done an analysis of this, and I would submit to you that in a safety-based claim, which was also alleged by Mr. Castro, the Ross factors, the majority of the important ones here, are met.
Why are they important and unimportant?
Well, there's a couple of them that don't apply at all. There's actually, in fact, a Ross factor that really only applies to injuries to healthcare employees. I believe it's one of the factors. I can go over them, but so let's just talk about them very quickly, one through seven. I've got plenty of time. The first one is, did the negligence of the defendant occur in the course of the defendant's performing tasks with the purpose of protecting patient from harm? That's the first factor. Well, that's not traditionally a healthcare, as we think of it as, you know, surgical or nursing care, those kind of
Correct.
Things. But Mr. Castro alleged, yes, the people that were there to take care of him didn't take care of him. They didn't supervise him. They didn't walk him in the lobby. This was a man who had ambulatory issues. He admits it. In his briefing, I had a stroke, I had problems moving around, they owed me a duty to make sure that I was not hurt, they failed, and I fell down. So factor one, easily met. Factor two, did the injuries occur in a place where the patients might be during the time where they were receiving care? So that the obligation of the provider here, my client, to protect the person who required special medical care was implicated? The answer, yes. We can look at the Smith case, as I've called it repeatedly, a Smith case. Forgive me. It's the Faber matter. In Faber, that was a sidewalk. There are other cases where, when you have a custodial relationship because there is a care need, such as in the case of Mr. Castro, who required help, that yes, the area of care extends beyond the exam room. It extends beyond the operating room. It can go into a sidewalk, as in Faber. It can go into buses when there's a tour of a assisted living facility and the bus stops.
And even under the Second Amendment petition where he alleges that he slipped and fell going into the restroom.
That was the Second Amendment petition, yeah.
That would fall under this as well, wouldn't it?
I would argue that does not change things dramatically at all. He can keep excising and scooping out facts, but and the fact that he completely changed sort of where the incident occurred, I don't think makes a lot of difference in this analysis. The main thing being is this gentleman certainly alleged that he required certain types of ambulatory assistance that was not provided. And so, you know, he can keep trying. And that was what was done in Faber also. They kept carving out, taking out more and more facts to where it just read like a typical premises liability claim. And the Supreme Court majority said, yeah, you don't get to just keep scooping things away. It doesn't really change the character.
Even if it had been pled all along as a slip and fall case?
No.
If it was, my question would be, you still must apply the Ross factors to decide whether it's a healthcare liability case.
That's an important point that I didn't make. There is a presumption that when you file a claim
right.
for personal injury against a healthcare provider, you are making a claim under the act, under the statute.
Right.
So you're 100% right. There must be a Ross analysis, at the very least, if it's a safety-based claim.
Right.
My position is that they're both a safety-based claim and a healthcare claim. The third Ross factor we've kind of touched upon.
Counsel, I have a quick question.
Yes, Justice Silva.
The second factor. Was there any indication in the record that Mr. Castro had any sort of physician's direction to be assisted by staff?
Yeah, it's interesting because that was an issue that came up in Faber, actually, because there was a contract. That was a very interesting case with a lot more of a robust record. There was no contract. We went straight from his petition, his pleadings, and then, of course, we submitted a, this is more of a factual aspect of the case, but there was a emergency room record which had facts in it that indicated that he did have a fall in the lobby and that he was had ambulatory issues that prevented him from walking without assistance to some extent. So in answer to your question, no, there's not a contract as in like the Faber case where they had very like there was a contract in Faber as well as medical records from her primary care physician saying, depending on her level of cognition and mentation, how healthy she was, she may need additional assistance. On the day of her incident, she did, in fact, and was using a walker with the assistance of a patient care assistant. So there is a slight distinction between those two things, except in this case, Mr. Castro certainly conceded in the first two petitions that he was impaired, required these things, was there for therapy, and that they should have done. They had a duty to do so, is the way he qualifies it. Did I answer your question, Justice Silva?
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Justice Benavides, would you like me to continue on with the Ross factors?
I didn't want to leave that. I know you're running out of time, and I didn't want you to go side by side. I just wanted to grasp your understanding of how what happened to Mr. Castro fits under the Ross standard.
Yes.
Because I was doing what you were doing and kind of going, yes, no, yeah, well, maybe not.
So let's go ahead. I've got a few more, and I can move through them fairly quickly.
Okay.
Number three, the third Ross factor is at the time of the injury, was the claimant in the process of seeking or receiving health care? Obviously, yes. He's admitted that he was there for therapy. That's fairly clear. Number four is not applicable. That is the healthcare worker factor. Those are, you know, we see those often in like a psychiatric case where maybe a worker is injured by a combative patient or something like that. Ross factor five is the alleged negligence based on a safety standard arising from professional duties owed by a healthcare worker? I've cited in my case to Omaha Healthcare versus Johnson, as well as the Ollie matter. Those are interesting cases. The Ollie matter involved a slip and fall of an impaired patient on a bathroom floor. The Omaha Healthcare is one of my favorite cases. It deals with a gentleman who was in a nursing home who was injured when he was bit by a brown recluse spider. Both of those cases qualified under the safety prong of the healthcare liability statute. And so in answer to number five under Ross, Castro did assert that there were duties owed that were consistent with a safety standard. In his parlance, in his petitions, it was the duty to assist and to supervise and make sure he didn't fall while on premises. Number six is a negative. That's the instrumentality one. Number seven is, did the alleged negligence occur in the course of the defendant taking action or failing to take action necessary to comply with safety-related requirements? For healthcare providers, the answer is, and this is usually for governmental agencies or accrediting agencies, I mean, this is a JCO hospital, but it's not, I'll concede, it's not part of the record. Nevertheless, Castro still asserted that there was a duty owed. So if we look at that almost more from a judicial admission standard, he did put explicitly within his live pleadings up until the point of the last one, that there was a duty owed by this hospital. So I think
I understand that, you know, as you carve out, you can only carve out so much, but can we get the plaintiff is entitled to amend their pleadings in order to effectuate and I don't want to say take it out of a healthcare liability because I mean I know that that's what ends up happening or trying to do, but couldn't this have been a straight slip and fall case?
I don't think so the way he pled it.
My question was. Was there a way to plead it without being a healthcare?
Because
that's what I was trying to ascertain.
You would still need to do a Ross analysis. And if he was there for treatment and had not yet begun his treatment, there are cases where someone is on premises, but these all predate the 2022-2023 case law out there, which more strongly suggests that you can't continue to amend and amend. You know, they are citing the Luisiga case. They're right. Citing the Yamada case. I mean, those cases have now coalesced with this, I believe, a more holistic view of you cannot continue to sort of plead these things out of the statute. But, you know, in answer to your question, If somebody were to go and they had not yet established a patient relationship with the facility and injures themselves on a crack in the sidewalk and plead it, I think you would still go through a Ross analysis, but I don't think in a case like that there's much, there's a high probability of ending up before a panel like
that. Yeah, that's what I was trying to, as I looked at the case law it has derived, it just seems like if you're a patient, it's going to be a healthcare liability.
It's certainly a stronger presumption.
Right. I mean, I just think that presumption is almost, unfortunately, becoming impossible to overcome. And it's hard to, I think that they're trying to plead him a slip and fall, but the problem is that the facts are that he was a patient there to receive medical treatment when he slipped and fell. See what I mean?
I do.
So that's differentiating the facts of the case as to what the underlying cause of action is.
Very, very much so. But and if I could, I know I've got a red light blinking, but I have one sentence, and it's just an important thing to point out, is while Mr. Castro, in the original petition and First Amendment petition, did assert, by the way, this is also a premises liability case, if you look through that record, and the record is very small, he never asserts what the premises liability fact is. He does not assert an unreasonably dangerous condition or indicate that it was present for, you know, other than the kind of bare common law language that would support a claim like that. So there is a, practical perspective, the focus of his pleading is the healthcare liability claim. And so I, unless there's another question, I'd certainly like to turn it over to my opponent over here and will happily address anything on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court, counsel.
Good morning.
Thank you for the opportunity to argue. That's my first time in this court of appeal, Your Honor.
Welcome.
Thank you. First of all, Your Honor, Texas law, common law, far precedes all the Chapter 74. The right to amend the pleading is a fundamental right of our legal system. Not able to amend pleadings and calling it carving out, it's like carving it in. A person walks in a place and falls. Opposing counsel is coming in with all the facts that have not been established. He was not a patient at the time, Your Honor. That's a fact issue, and therefore this appellate court should eliminate the argument asserting facts that are not in the record. What we have is a person who walked in and went to the bathroom and fell.
He was not there for therapy, as indicated in the briefs?
And Your Honor, the amended pleading says he went there to take an appointment. So he was not technically a patient. Whether they would have given an appointment or not, was he shopping around for an appointment, is not part of the record, Your Honor. The second part, Your Honor, is not allowing a patient or a regular person to file a regular common law claim basically would make the Chapter 74 cut down the statute of limitation to 1 year. Additionally, Your Honor, let's assume for the sake of argument, as my opposing counsel was doing, that he had filed and got an expert under Chapter 74. What would have been the position of defendant? We haven't done anything medical to him. There is no expertise for anybody involved. There is no facility that would say, oh, as soon as you walk into a place like this, somebody has to walk you through. So all the assumptions he's working on would have been used exactly to eliminate it, that it doesn't fall. There is no violation of any.
Well, theoretically, it would have been you would have been alleging a safety issue, and you'd have an expert testifying on safety standards.
Let me back up from just, and I don't want to, to go back. And where you started this argument was, can you carve out? Can you make whatever argument? And that was my last question to appellant, was, is there any way to plead your case based on the facts that would have not made it a healthcare? And I think that the argument is being made that it could not, that this on its face, that's what the appellant is arguing, had to be appellee. Appellant's right. The appellant is the hospital is making that no matter how you attempt it to be, the presumption is that it's a health care and there's no way. Because that is my issue with your right. It is your right to plead it however you wish to plead it. And that is still, but sometimes the facts stick us in a hole that no matter how hard we try to get out, we can't. And so is there a way you could have pled this that would have not made it a healthcare liability case?
Your Honor, I believe the life pleading, which is the second amended pleading, is exactly doing that.
Okay.
And if they felt it's not, they should have attacked that pleading as opposed to say, let's look at all the record.
But the Supreme Court is directing us that we have to look at the entire record. We can't just ignore the first two pleadings.
But in fact, there are no facts to support the health care in this particular case, Your Honor. There are no facts presented or that are in the record to tie.
But the requirement to file an expert report is based on pleadings. If somebody files a lawsuit, you know, under the Health Care Liability Act, that triggers then the expert report requirement.
Your Honor, it is a presumption. It's not an irrebuttable presumption. Let's say you look at the facts, you take a case, you look at the facts, you conduct discovery, and no, he hasn't had any interaction with any healthcare person there. He didn't walk in, he didn't get any treatment, he didn't get put in a wheelchair to be wheeled in, he didn't ask any medical assistance of any kind. He was just, it would be exactly in the same position if I'm going to visit someone in a healthcare center and I need to go to the restroom.
But was there any discovery done before this? In this time frame to be able to establish those facts?
There was some discovery, Your Honor, but that nothing that established that he was a patient, Your Honor. And in fact, I asked the court to consider what would a expert in a particular case come up with to create a claim of a violation of a Health Care Act. It's exactly similar if I'm walking to the HEB, I go to the restroom and I slip and fall. This case is no different than any slip and fall case.
No, it's very different because it's a healthcare
initially
entity. Yeah.
So in fact, it was unartfully pled initially, Your Honor. It was corrected and answering, Your Honor, it was pled. The live pleading, our position is exactly making a case that this is not a Health Care Act violation. I have no other questions.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You may proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court. I don't want to perseverate on things. I think we sort of know where our position is, and my opposing counsel's position is relatively clear. I do want to address a couple of things, just as a practical matter. Obviously the right to amend is their primary argument here, but the Chapter 74 is very clear in its prefatory language. It indicates that it's notwithstanding any other law. It's meant to be a broadly interpreted and applied law. The Texas Supreme Court has been very clear in its application in these kind of cases, and I'm always a little bit surprised, you know, when I see them come in, but, it's good to have a lively argument or discussion about what they mean. I don't believe, as I've stated, that the current state of the Supreme Court jurisprudence is that a case can be amended over and over again to sort of carve out or excise the kind of healthcare flavor of a file or a cause of action to eventually, you know, push it outside of the statute. In fact, I think the court has been very clear that that's something that it does not support. And we could again look at, you know, Loisiga and Yamada and the other matters that are cited within Faber. One of the things that my opponent mentioned was, you know, what kind of expert do we get in a case like this? What kind of expert do we get to meet Chapter 74's requirement? I think this is an argument that's been made before, but in a case like this, it is fairly straightforward. It is a simple hospitalist can talk about the duties and responsibilities to take care of somebody who has ambulatory issues while on premises, or it can be a nursing person and then a medical doctor to talk about causation, two reports. This is not an impossible hurdle. It's not even a difficult hurdle. Frankly, the standard for Chapter 74 expert reports is exceedingly low. I don't know about this court in particular, but across the state, it seems that there is a declination in challenges to expert reports because the threshold for meeting the statutory requirements under Palacios and the progeny has sort of been willowed down. So there really doesn't need to be too much discussion in that. So that's not a hurdle that should really be something that would impede this case being reversed.
Let me ask you about one thing that counsel for Appley said. It was that it was not clear in the record that the gentleman, Mr. Acosta, was established to be a patient.
Yeah, I mean, he says he is. He says he is a patient, and if I may step away from a moment, he said he went there for occupational and physical therapy due to suffering from a stroke as a matter of standard. Any patient who has suffered from an illness or disease is to be supervised at all time when ambulating. A plaintiff was making his way to the lobby of said facility and suddenly fell and fractured his rib. I think there's an error here on the record, but I think it meant to say that the defendant knew plaintiff was not being assisted by the employees of South Texas Rehab. It was only when he fell that they realized that he was not assisted. So he is certainly insinuating that he...
I guess, does it matter in the big picture? Let's assume I'm walking into a doctor just to see if I can make an appointment. No doctor-patient relationship has been established. Does it matter?
I think that gets into a very nuanced question. I think it depends. I think when we look at the way that he has framed his facts in his case, it doesn't matter here. If we're going to look at it in sort of the narrowest view, which is what does it mean in this case, it doesn't matter.
I'm always concerned, though, of the nuances because we're creating law of what the next case is and
right.
what we're saying as precedent value. Right. And that's my concern, as we look at this record.
Yeah, and as you sort of indicated from the previous oral arguments today, that seems to be your primary focus. And I think we can draw a really narrow kind of stripe on either side of this case because of the way it was pled. There was no discovery that was done that I'm aware of because, as you know, in a Chapter 74 situation, before a report is filed, discovery is stayed. There was some medical records that we submitted as a supplement to bolster our arguments that this gentleman was there for therapy and that he fell in the lobby injuring himself. But, the reality is that while it was discussed earlier that sometimes these cases are decided on the pleadings alone, obviously there are situations where when there's no report required or no report served, that maybe additional records be submitted that would be looked at in view of almost like a summary judgment type motion. This was not so much the case. We were mostly focusing on the pleadings and the way that Mr. Castro, presented his facts and framed his claims. So I hope that I've covered all the nuances on this one. Did not suggest a overbroad approach to this. I think the application to this case is fairly narrow.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
The case will be under submission.